From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, a baker turns away a same-sex couple. Now he's in court.
Well, I won't provide the service that goes against my core beliefs, and I can't be forced to do something against my will, regardless of what the law says.
Also, a lot of people hate their internet provider. But not in Tennessee.
Well, if people outside of Chattanooga are unhappy with their internet, my first duty is to say, come here. We're friendly. We're in the South. We're nice people.
Plus, R&B legend Sharon Jones beats cancer.
I'm getting the music back into me. You know, I'm coming back to give the people what they want, some more soul music.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. The White House has been working hard to fix the well-publicized problems with the Affordable Care Act. But there is at least one big problem that's outside the president's power to fix. The question of whether employers should have to provide contraception coverage to their employees. The Supreme Court will be deciding that one. They're currently considering a challenge to the contraception requirement by a group of nuns called the Little Sisters of the Poor. But the case raises questions that reverberate beyond health coverage. How do you protect religious freedom when the beliefs of individuals and churches or businesses come into conflict? That's our cover story today. We start with the case before the Supreme Court. The Little Sisters of the Poor are being represented by the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. Christina Arriaga is the fund's director, and she says the sisters are as selfless as their name implies.
They devote their lives to serving the poor elderly, people that have nowhere else to go in their last years. And the sisters, under the new HHS Health and Human Services mandate, are being forced by the government to either sign a form allowing a third party to provide contraceptives and abortion-causing drugs to their employees, or they're being threatened with fines.
A lot of critics are asking, what's the big deal about signing a form? The form is there expressly for church-affiliated groups like the sisters, so they can register loud and clear that they're opting out of contraception coverage. But Arriaga says the provision doesn't do enough to protect religious liberty.
Well, the Little Sisters of the Poor feel that whether they provide the contraceptives or these potentially life-terminating drugs to their employees, or they make someone else do it, it's the same thing. It's a sin. They're not allowed by their God to provide these medications to their employees. And they simply cannot, in good conscience, sign that form. And their conscientious objection should absolutely be respected by the government.
And this gets us to the core questions. Who has the right to religious liberty? And what does it mean to exercise that right? Jay Michelson is a fellow at the Liberal Political Research Associates who wrote a report titled Redefining Religious Liberty, the Covert Campaign Against Civil Rights.
I think we'd all agree that a church shouldn't be compelled to perform a religious ceremony that it doesn't want to perform. Then the next level up is religious organizations, so Catholic hospitals, Catholic charities. Do they have to obey the same laws as everyone else, or do they have a separate set of laws that applies only to them?
And what about religious liberty for individual people, Americans who bring their religious beliefs outside the church and into their businesses? To answer that, we're going to Lakewood, Colorado, west of Denver.
Yeah, I'm Jack Phillips from Masterpiece Cake Shop, and we make specialty cakes and cookies and brownies here in Lakewood, Colorado.
The shop's website boasts that if you can think it up, Phillips can make it into a cake. He's owned the shop for 20 years.
I'm a follower of Jesus Christ, and so I try in every aspect of my life to reflect that in every way I want to have integrity in my life and honesty and love for my fellow man and do everything to the best of my ability to honor him.
Philip says his faith affects everything he does, including how he runs his business. Last September, that became a problem.
Two gentlemen came in my store and said that they were here to look for a wedding cake. It was for their wedding. And so I replied that I don't do cakes for same-sex weddings. They were surprised and kind of asked for an explanation, like, what? And so I explained to him that I would make their birthday cakes, sell them cookies and brownies, but I just don't do cakes for same-sex weddings, at which point they both stormed out of the shop. I just didn't feel that, as a Christian, that I would want to participate in a same-sex wedding by providing the cake and my talents and my business for that event.
A few weeks later, Phillips got a notice from the state. The ACLU had filed a lawsuit on behalf of the two men. They say his refusal is illegal discrimination. Phillips says he is protected by his First Amendment right to live according to his religious beliefs. In December, a judge sided with the ACLU and ordered Phillips to provide the cakes for same-sex ceremonies. Phillips has appealed the decision, but his case is just one of many like it. In Washington, another baker and a florist were both sued, and an Oregon bakery is under investigation for refusing to bake a cake for a gay couple. Christina Arriaga of the Beckett Fund says devout business owners have a right to refuse.
Many of these bakers and service providers for weddings feel that by participating in the wedding ceremony itself, they're acknowledging in some way that these are valid marriages and their religion tells them otherwise.
What about the argument that this is looking at liberty and rights from the wrong direction? Say the freedom of same-sex couples to be married and express their vows before God in a way that's consistent with their religion and prohibiting them from getting married suppresses their basic right to their religious expression.
Oh, we at the Beckett Fund think that they have a right to get married in states that afford them that right. However, they should not be forcing individuals who do not agree with their marriage to participate in this ceremony. They should seek out parties that share their religious beliefs.
Jay Michelson believes that the legal battles reflect a cultural shift in America.
I think there's a real sense of a cultural war being lost, and that sense is not entirely inaccurate. We are changing as a country. Having our first African-American president is a massive change. Having same-sex marriage be legal for over 30% of Americans is a significant change. And these changes are authentically terrifying. I think it is a sincere movement. There are a number of people who really believe that we've lost our moral center when it comes to matters of sexuality and gender. They have pretty good reasons for that. I just think that the cure is not abridging people's freedom, but coming to a more expansive understanding of what being in a civil democracy is about.
At Masterpiece Cake Shop, the fight continues. Jack Phillips has appealed his case on religious liberty grounds. But what if he loses and the courts say he must provide cakes for same-sex ceremonies?
Well, I won't provide the service. It goes against my core beliefs, and I can't be forced to do something against my will, regardless of what the law says.
He knows he could be fined or even have his business license taken away.
Yeah, that's a small price to pay for my faith and for my citizenship.
Jack Phillips is just one of many Americans locked in the battle over competing notions of religious liberty. New Year's resolutions are a cliché, but I have one I bet you haven't heard before. Tons of people resolve to give up things like eating too much, drinking to excess, or staying in bad relationships. We have a man who decided to give up God. And that man is an ordained minister in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Last year, Ryan Bell left the congregation he led, and earlier this month he announced his plans to try on atheism. Soon after that, the Christian University and the seminary where he taught asked him to resign. Bell says the questioning that led to all of this actually started long ago.
My entire adult life, I've been a leader in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And I think the expectation of church leaders is that they would have fewer questions and more answers, and that the members or the seekers or people who come to the church are the ones with the questions. And I can't remember a time when I wasn't wrestling with my faith.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think faith is one of those things that people wrestle with.
How then did we get from there to this experiment you've embarked upon to try to live for a year without God?
Like when things start to come unwound, sometimes they unwind all the way. And then, you know, perhaps you can wind it up a little bit again later. Who knows? But I feel like I lost my church leadership position, and then I really didn't have any compulsion to go to church internally. Like I just didn't feel like participating in church life. I tried a number of times, and mm-hmm. It woke me up to the kinds of things people had been saying to me all these years. Like, I love what you're doing at the church, but church just isn't for me. And it wasn't that I was against it necessarily or that I thought the people who were there were doing something wrong. It was just that it wasn't connecting for me. So I just decided not to fight it. You know, I just decided to say, well, let me just give church a rest. And as I did that, I just began to wonder about the very existence of God.
How are your old friends, you know, from the church, have they been reacting to this?
Some people have been just encouraging. Some people have just been sort of silently watching. Some are a little heartbroken. It's almost like people respond as though I've lost a loved one, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm going through a deep grieving process and doing strange things as a result, you know. And some people have just tried to talk me off the ledge. Others have said, I have these same questions and I'm really glad that you're doing this and I'll be following along. Maybe I'll figure some things out along the way too. I'm not saying to my former members, follow me out the door, you know, nothing like that. I don't want them to do that. I want them to be on their own journey authentically.
And what has been the reaction from the atheist community? Has there been a lot of excitement about, well, we got one on our team or more subtle than that?
A little bit. Yeah, maybe a little bit from some quarters. Some people are, in a way, gloating. They're like, congratulations on coming to the other side or whatever. But other people are skeptical. There are a lot of atheists who are really not sure what I'm doing. So they say either you are an atheist or you're not. You can't be a little atheist, like you're a little bit pregnant. In a way, what I hear them saying is you're not authentically atheist.
Not a proper atheist?
Not a proper atheist. And my internal reaction to some of that is to say, oh, I was a Christian leader for a long time. I've heard that argument on the other side as well. You're not properly Christian. You're not Christian in our way of being a Christian, so you don't really fit here. And my response to that is, look, I'm used to not fitting places, so that's fine with me. There are people that have reached out to me that said, look, I grew up in a family. We went to the Unitarian Universalist Church. I'm an atheist, and I go to church every Sunday. And it's not a problem. I think it depends on where your starting point is. And if your faith community and if your social community can contain those questions, then you ask and answer those questions within the framework of that community. If your community cannot contain those questions, then you step outside of it and it's more painful and messy.
Ryan Bell is going to be living this year without God. He joined us here in our studios in Culver City, California. Ryan, thank you so much. It's very interesting talking with you.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you as well. Thank you.
The McDonnell Douglas DC-9 once ruled the skies, but those days are long gone.
Get up and go. Cover mid-America at 560 miles per hour aboard Ozark Airlines' new DC-9 jets by Douglas. The time you save will be all your own.
The DC-9 first took flight in 1965, and production stopped in 1982. While most airlines phased the planes out in the 1990s, Delta held on, overhauling the fleet and keeping them in the air until now. On Monday, Delta Flight 2014 from Minneapolis to Atlanta marked the last scheduled commercial flight for a DC-9 on a major U.S. airline. At Atlanta International Airport, Captain Scott Wolfrey stands inside one of the now retired planes that will head to its final resting place in Blytheville, Arkansas.
The DC-9 is a workhorse.
He knows how these planes perform. Wolfrey's flown them since 1997, and he piloted Monday's final flight as the sun set across the horizon.
As we took off at 4:30, it was light out, and as we got closer and closer to Atlanta, the skies turned kind of an amber to a deep purple, then set completely on the aircraft. We arrived, it was dark, and taxied to the gate. Very symbolic of the flight.
Wolfrey calls the DC-9 a pilot's plane, in a way you just don't see anymore. Entering the cockpit is almost like stepping back in time.
It's all analog gauges. Pilots are very intimately involved in flying the aircraft, flying by needles and balls and with a single autopilot.
And there's no GPS.
We navigate by ground-based radio beacons. Our needles point to a station, and then we get a distance from a station. So we know where we are. We use the old paper charts, and we navigate that way.
Over nearly a half century of service, the DC-9 opened up jet travel to hundreds of smaller communities. Its compact size let it land on short runways in places that previously had to rely on slower propeller planes. Wolfrey says the best memories he has are flying these planes over mountains to land at airports in little towns that dot the West.
It's undescribable in clear weather to start your descent, and it's almost a two-dimensional view. And then once you get down into the mountains like Helena or Bozeman and see the majestic peaks around you, it's just absolutely amazing sight.
These days, the DC-9s are outdated. They're noisy and not fuel efficient. But Wolfrey says they're fun to fly and he'll miss taking them up.
It brought us from Minneapolis to Atlanta safely and comfortably and kind of nostalgic, just setting the brakes for the last time.
That's Captain Scott Wolfrey. On Monday, he flew Delta's last DC-9 flight from Minneapolis to Atlanta. Everyone loves hugs, right? Well, no. For those of us who aren't fans, things can get really awkward. In a recent piece for Time.com, research psychologist Peggy Drexler was not ashamed to state her position.
Nope, I'm not a hugger.
So how do you get out of it?
Well, if it's in the office, you keep something between you and the hugger until the moment passes. Another is to be straight out and say, sorry, I'm not much of a hugger. You can resist and take physical control with a stiff handshake and a firm elbow that keeps personal space intact. You can escape and find something that requires your immediate attention. And if nothing comes to mind, drop your cell phone and then just pick it up.
What motivated you to go public with your anti-hugging stance?
Well, you know, it started first when I had graduated after my PhD. I saw a well-loved professor on the street, and she was coming towards me, and all of a sudden I knew that she was going in for the hug. And I thought, it struck me, I don't want this, but how can I get out of it without being hurtful or graceless? And then, I don't know if you remember in July, the mayor of San Diego was a serial harasser.
He gave hugging a bad name, I think. He said,
yes, he did. He said, I'm a hugger. He said, I'm just a hugger. It got me thinking again that it is part of the culture at this point, what is acceptable and what isn't. And we all have feelings about it.
I guess we should draw the distinction for different social situations here, because there are some people who are comfortable, say, hugging their friends. But this thing of now hugging in the workplace, I think for a lot of people, they're not quite sure how to handle that.
I think it is a concern. In the workplace, hugging has different implications for men and women. Women can look like the office mom.
Hmm.
And too much hugging can make a man look creepy.
I think we've all seen that, too.
Yeah. And my feeling is you don't hug anybody you supervise. In a big win, you might hug sideways, you know, put your arm around their shoulder. In personal loss, if somebody gets married, you can give a congratulations hug. But hug sparingly. If it's someone you see in your everyday life, you can become known as a serial hugger, and it's a bit creepy. Don't whisper anything creepy or scary. Don't close your eyes. Don't hug anybody from behind. Never in a restroom, for obvious reason. But I think the main rule is if you wonder if a hug is appropriate, it probably isn't.
Now, is this hugging mania particularly American?
Now, these are generalizations, okay?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But Asian cultures generally hesitate about physical affection, mm-hmm. Especially in public. But then you get to Latin America, and it's kind of like, bring it on. And Russia, they hug, they kiss, they slap on the back. And France is a quick peck on the cheek with minimal body contact.
So, I mean, I guess it's just something difficult about America, the wonderful thing about the diversity, but it's difficult to figure out what's the single right way to interact with people.
Well, I think that's the point, that there is none at this point, and there is hugging anxiety. It's something that's in the zeitgeist, but we really haven't, you know, made any rules. My own rule is I won't hug if you don't.
Peggy Drexler is a research psychologist who has recently come out against the rampant hugging that seems to be taking over America. Peggy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Arun.
Here around Los Angeles, there are plenty of celebrities who look unnaturally young. One character in particular looks especially amazing for someone who died in 1946.
I am H.G. Wells. I'm your host this evening and every evening. Oh, please, I don't do that for applause. I do that to see who doesn't applaud.
That's comedian Paul F. Tompkins. He becomes H.G. Wells for a monthly series at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. Wells activates his time machine to pull famous writers back from the beyond for improvised interviews called Dead Authors. The night I was there, it was Wells in conversation with Tennessee Williams, played by the hilarious Kristen Schaal, wearing a white suit and fake mustache. You'll hear that in a bit. But first, I asked Paul F. Tompkins exactly how much historical research he expects from his actors.
People are always daunted at first. Like, I don't really know that much about, you know, whoever. And I say, it doesn't matter. You can pick anyone you want. I will do all the research, and I will only ask you questions that you can answer any way you want. I call them emotional questions, uh-huh. so that I will never ask for a fact or a date or anything like that. I'll just say, this happened. I'll lay it out for them and for the audience. How did that make you feel? And then they're free to say whatever they want.
I want to give people a little taste of your H.G. Wells, who has been called the father of science fiction.
That's
and
right.
What I like about it is that we get to hear H.G. Wells talk some trash about other writers. Let's hear a little bit of you as H.G. Wells.
Jules Verne, of course, the author of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which its very title is incorrect. League is not a measure of depth. It is a measure of distance going rather more horizontally. Although at least it shows some imagination, because the rest of the book, frankly, just takes things that exist and then writes them down. Oh no, a giant squid! There are giant squids. It's neither science nor fiction.
What do you do for research to get into the mind of H.G. Wells?
I have, of all the research that I've done on authors for the show, I think H.G. Wells is the one I've researched the least. Sometimes it's completely unnecessary. I did one, episode 20 had John Hodgman of The Daily Show and the author of those great books as Ayn Rand. And I spent, there's pages and pages about Ayn Rand, pages and pages on Wikipedia. And I spent a couple hours in a hotel room in San Francisco. This is part of the San Francisco Sketchfest. Turning down lunch invitations, all this stuff, condensing.
You were cramming.
Yeah, I was cramming, yeah. And then he, I think, let me get out two questions. He just, in character, was just rambling on and on and on. And it was hilarious. But I did regret not accepting those lunch invitations.
So one of the shows that I caught recently was you had Kristen Schaal as Tennessee Williams.
Yeah.
Maybe gender bending is a theme with these authors, with you.
It's happened many times.
And she just chewed it up.
She was hilarious.
Tennessee Williams was savaged by critics late in life. And well, let's hear. Here's Kristen Schaal as Tennessee Williams talking about that.
Have you heard of Red Devil Battery Sign? Red Devil Battery Sign.
I've heard of it, yes.
They said it was They said it was I used to be the one they said was saving the American theater by myself. And then all of a sudden you write something like Red Devil Battery Sign and now you're and then you drink more, and then that makes you write weirder stuff. And then you start taking sleeping pills and drinking, and you're writing things are coming to you, and you're putting them out there, and everybody's like, you're So I died.
Hey. That's actually a pretty good summary of the end of Tennessee Williams. This is not to laugh about it.
No, certainly not. But it is succinct. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've noticed about the show is that all the performers seem to gravitate towards the bitterness that can come out of a career in writing. And there's a lot of jealousy. There's a lot of anger at people that rip people off and so much anger at critics. And it comes up again and again.
So you do interviews not in character. You have this podcast series in which you do these great interviews, which is kind of rude. I don't try to do stand-up. But is there something something about this format?
You know, I really like talking to people. You know, my social trick always in a situation where someone's asking me about my life is to turn it back around on them. And honestly, it's not completely just a deflection move. It's like I am genuinely interested in hearing what they have to say. There's always something about the way people choose to tell you about themselves mm-hmm. that is interesting.
Paul F. Tompkins is the host of the Dead Authors podcast. Paul, it's a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
The pleasure was mine, Arun. Thank you so much.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. We posed a simple question on our Facebook page this week. How satisfied are you with your internet service provider? We heard a lot of frustration.
How do I like my internet service? I hate my internet service right now.
I'm not a big fan of my internet service.
I don't like my internet service.
Goes out at least once a day.
It's overpriced.
Painfully slow. Painfully slow.
But there aren't any other quality options in my area.
The American Customer Satisfaction Index surveys large swaths of consumers about various industries. And in last year's survey, Americans rated internet service providers at the very bottom for satisfaction. That puts ISPs below the postal service, health insurance, even airlines. Critics of the telecom industry say Americans are paying too much money for slow speeds and bad service. The industry says those charges are way overblown. That's our cover story today. Has the country that invented the internet fallen behind? Now, not everyone we spoke to has had a bad experience.
I'm John Lemich. I live in Columbia, Maryland. I really like my internet service, actually. I get pretty good download and upload speeds, exactly as advertised. It very rarely has any problems. And their customer service has been great.
And Lemich says he has several options. His neighborhood has cable, but also access to Verizon's high-speed fiber-optic internet. That's not true for everyone, because the map of broadband access is a patchwork. In rural areas, you might have only satellite. Even in cities, the menu can be limited. Some people just get access through their smartphone. Others might be stuck with a single cable provider, or DSL.
My name is Breanne Neal, and I am from Hudson, Illinois.
Breanne Neal has DSL, and her service is much slower than advertised. That makes life frustrating, especially for her daughter, who spends a lot of time waiting for video to load.
She watches a lot of TV series on Netflix. I think Vampire Diaries is the one she's currently watching.
But it's more serious than keeping up with the vampires. Working from home or online banking can be fraught with headaches and delays. Neal says there are no other viable options in their area. She and her family are stuck.
There's no incentive for them to make it better for us because we're still paying them every month and they're still making money as a company and there's no competition.
Hudson, Illinois is a small town, so you might think there would be more options in the big city a few hours north.
Samantha Laws, Chicago.
Samantha Laws gets internet through her cable provider. She says it's her only option and she does not like it.
It goes out at least once a day. And it's been getting worse the last few months. With the pet sitting company I work for, we handle all of our scheduling through email and our company website. So there's been times where the internet's down, so I can't do my job, and then I have to text my boss and ask her if she can do it because I don't have internet access at the moment.
We also heard from one part of the country where things sound a bit better.
My name is Andy Burke from Chattanooga, Tennessee. We have the largest, fastest, most pervasive internet in the Western Hemisphere.
Andy Burke isn't just any resident of Chattanooga. He's the mayor. Several years ago, the public electric utility, the EPB, upgraded the power grid to fiber optic, mostly to help deal with power outages. But the utility saw an added benefit. That same grid can carry very high-speed internet. So for $70 a month, the utility now offers customers upload and download speeds of up to 1 gigabit per second. That's more than 100 times faster than the average U.S. connection. Just to give you a sense of that speed, imagine this 6-second Black Sabbath riff is a gigabit per second. And now, here it is slowed down to the average U.S. connection speed. Those 6 seconds turn into more than 10 minutes. For a lot of people, going to a gig a second might be a little overkill.
Well, it's funny because I tell people all the time, you don't need gigabit per second technology to load ESPN.com faster.
But Mayor Burke says the fiber optic grid is an investment in the future when more businesses will need that super fast broadband.
We're starting to see companies who are looking at us coming here, making decisions, who understand that they will need more capacity in the future, and Chattanooga has that today.
For example, he says a tech startup called QuickQ is growing and creating jobs in Chattanooga. But it's all come at a steep price. Installing the grid cost about $300 million. In some other places, private companies have made the investment. There's Verizon Fios, and Google has installed fiber in Kansas City and plans to expand to Austin, Texas, and Provo, Utah. Elsewhere in the country, options are more limited.
At least 77% of the country, your only choice for a high-capacity, high-speed internet connection is your local cable monopoly.
That's Susan Crawford. She's a visiting professor at Harvard Law School and the author of Captive Audience: The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age.
Imagine that you run a gold mine, and there's just one single railroad line running to your gold mine. That single railroad line on which you depend for getting your product out to the world and for hearing from the outside world, the equivalent of that is high-speed internet access infrastructure. And just as in the Gilded Age, those railroad lines were controlled by a very few moguls who divided up the country between themselves and never competed and gouged everybody, today, high-speed internet access in America is controlled by a series of local cable monopolies who are similarly not subject to competition and also not subject to any kind of oversight.
Crawford says as a consequence, the U.S. has fallen far behind other countries in providing broadband.
I think it's fair to say the U.S. is at best in the middle of the pack. And when it comes to fiber optic penetration, we're way down at the bottom in terms of speed and price.
Well, how did, you know, America did invent the internet? How did we get so far behind?
We got there because of failures in policy. This doesn't happen by magic. These major infrastructure businesses aren't like other market businesses. It's very expensive to install them in the first place, and then they build up enormous barriers of entry around them. It really doesn't make sense to try to compete with a player like Comcast or Time Warner Cable for another private actor to do it.
So what Crawford is calling for is a major public works project to install fiber optic infrastructure, a public grid that private companies could then use to deliver internet service.
The right approach for us is to have the mayors of America stand up and say, this is ridiculous. You know, we need to make sure that businesses move to us. And the way to do that is to use your power over your rights of way and your streets and simply rip up the streets once and then make sure that every home and every business in your city has this fiber-to-the-home connection, which is upgradable into infinity.
Not everyone agrees with Crawford's comparison of the broadband market to Gilded Age railroad barons.
I think it's a badly exaggerated view, and the analogy is not particularly compelling.
Michael Powell is a former chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, and he's now the president of the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, which lobbies Congress on behalf of the industry.
She mentions the cable industry, but fails to mention the telephone industry, which is a very vigorous competitor for broadband as well. And I also think, with all respect, she tends to omit the entire wireless market, in which the United States is one of the world's leading providers. And I think to exclude it as a substitutable competitive alternative, I just think is an error that leads you to believe the market is substantially more concentrated than it actually is.
Another complaint Susan Crawford and other critics have of the U.S. is that the U.S. has fallen behind a lot of other countries in terms of broadband affordability and speed. You found those comparisons false, right?
I think by any measure, America is unquestionably in the leadership pack. This reminds me a little bit of an Olympic speed skating race. And if you take a picture, maybe there's a few seconds separating them and you could rank them, but nobody's meaningfully out of the race. I think taking a snapshot and declaring us as somehow dangerously falling behind is just not substantiated by the data and is an inaccurate way to look at these comparisons.
Well, you know, however we do compare it, you know, American Customer Satisfaction Index surveys rate internet service providers at the bottom of their ranking. It seems that customers across America are not happy. They're feeling like it is too slow and too costly. So why do you think that providers are getting the low marks?
Yeah, you know, I've read that. I haven't seen the data behind it. So specifically, is it because of speed or cost is unclear. I do think there is an experience that's very different in the United States, which can bring in a whole host of feelings. And that is most internet high speed is sold in bundles in this country. You know, their feelings and their reactions around that total package sometimes can't be that easily separated into its parts. You know, and I think we as an industry have recognized that is an important deficiency that we're working hard to address. I think customer satisfaction is really critical. But at the same time, you know, the growth and use of those services and the amount of increased money consumers tend to invest in communication services, even when they have other alternatives, I think to some degree speaks for itself.
What do you make of efforts for cities to provide municipal broadband in places like Chattanooga, Tennessee?
I'm one of the people who don't scream about this. I think the citizens of individual communities are free to make those choices through their elected representatives if they want. I think as a citizen, I would raise serious questions about the value of using public funding to the degree that is required to both build and I think what often is missed in localities, the constant expense of maintenance over years and decades worth of operation. And given that there is a robust private market serving virtually every corner of the country, I think it can be a questionable public decision. But, you know, these are choices to be made by local citizens.
That's Michael Powell, President and CEO of the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. As we heard, a lot of people are unhappy with their internet service. If you're unsatisfied, the government has a block-by-block database of broadband providers. We'll link to that at npr.org. There, you can find out if you have other options, or maybe like some, you're stuck with service you just don't like. Rosemary Mahoney's greatest fear was going blind. It makes sense for the award-winning writer. Mahoney's vision lends her books an uncanny quality that makes you really feel like you're with her. Weirdly, she says, she had never met a blind person. So Mahoney was apprehensive when she was assigned to write a profile of a woman running the first school for the blind in Tibet. Her experience there served as a prelude for a fuller immersion in the world of the blind, detailed in her new book, For the Benefit of Those Who See. After just a few days at the school, Rosemary Mahoney realized that she had to rethink everything she thought she knew about vision.
When sighted people cover their eyes or find themselves in a dark place, this is something that's very terrifying for us. And so, in general, we assume that this is what blindness means. But of course it isn't. For people who were born blind or who go blind at a very young age, that's not at all what blindness means. And even people who lose vision at an older age, yes, they go through a period of depression and utter despair, but eventually most blind people learn how to live in the world and the world doesn't feel black to them. I've rarely met a miserable, self-pitying blind person.
You talk about these misconceptions and actually take us through the history of blind people in human society. And what's shocking is that obviously blindness has been with us since we've been human. But the attitudes, the association of, say, blindness with mental infirmity, that's lasted up until very recently.
To me, the remarkable thing is it's pretty much unanimous the way blind people have been perceived in all cultures and for millennia. The first is, if they can't see, they must be stupid. The second one is, and this is a very old one, that blindness is such a terrible thing that it must be a curse from God for some evil that you committed. When Jesus and his disciples meet a blind man in the road, and the disciples say to him, Master, why was this man born blind? Who did sin, he or his parents? Because there was no other conception of why a person would be blind. It was a punishment from God. So the blind person must be evil and must be avoided and don't touch a blind person. And so blind people have suffered these things everywhere for centuries.
You know, one of the deep ironies, you kind of note this in your book, with a school in Tibet, is that these children who are told that they have no future, they're a burden, that by coming to this school, they actually have a much wider universe than they would have had in their villages.
That's right. And this is one of the remarkable things about Sabria Ten Birkin, who is blind. And she went to Tibet, and when she saw the way blind children were being treated, you know, abandoned by their parents, people throwing stones at them and spitting at them and calling them idiots, and parents would tie their kids to a bed all day so that they wouldn't hurt themselves. And of course, there was no education for them. Sabria got on horseback and rode across Tibet with two-sighted people going from village to village asking, are there any blind children here? I'm starting a school. would you be willing to send your child? And many of these people were happy to get rid of the kid. So what has happened in Tibet, because of the school, it's called Braille Without Borders, many blind children have been given an opportunity for an education in a way that many sighted people in these small villages have not been.
It seems that every blind person that you spoke with, when you talked about the possibility of restoring their vision, they seemed like they didn't want it. Why?
Well, that is a very interesting subject. You know, we always think, well, for a person who's blind, it must be an amazing, joyful miracle if by some chance their sight is restored to them. Now, this may be true for blind people who lost their vision at a later age. It's rarely true for people who were born blind or who go blind at a very young age. We are not born with effective vision. The human infant has to learn how to see. The eyes gather information, they transmit it to the brain, but the brain doesn't know how to process it yet. We learn how to see in a way that's very similar to the way we learn how to speak. It takes a couple of years. If the brain is deprived of this visual information at a very young age, it can never learn how to see again.
On the other side of things, some who have lost their sight as adults, they talk about what they've ended up gaining.
Right. Well, that is... I don't want to paint a pretty picture of blindness. It's not, it isn't ultimately a gift. It's what people make with their blindness that becomes the gift. Having to finally accept the fact that you are not just a sighted person who can't see anymore, but you are a blind person. There are, however, people who finally adapt to it after a great period of depression. And the more they embrace their blindness, the more they begin to realize what they were missing. One day, these two blind Tibetan teenagers blindfolded me and they guided me through the streets of Lhasa as a way of showing me what it's like to be a blind person living in the world and navigating. And they would say to me, okay, now we turn left. They had a very specific destination in mind. And I would say to them, well, how do you know we turn left? And they would say, do you hear the sound of many televisions in a shop right next to us? But I never noticed it. Because I'm so used to communing with the world with my vision that I don't notice what I smell, I rarely notice what I hear, and I certainly don't notice the pavement under my feet. And I began to think, this is interesting, not because these people are handicapped, but because I'm finding out I am, in some ways, equally handicapped.
Rosemary Mahoney talking about her new book, For the Benefit of Those Who See, Dispatches from the World of the Blind. Again, you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Rock. When I was a child, I believed what they told me. Everyone. To each one shall come what each one shall earn. This is the sheer excitement and boundless energy that is Sharon Jones. She and her band, the Dap Kings, have been leading a classic soul revival for more than 10 years now. You're listening to a track from their latest album, coming out on Tuesday, Give the People What They Want. I hesitate to call it their new album, though. It was supposed to be released back in August. But earlier that summer, Sharon Jones got the word that she had stage 2 pancreatic cancer. Everything came to a halt. Her illness didn't creep up on her, though. It hit her square in the back during a performance in Boise, Idaho.
I was on stage one night, and the pain hit me so hard, I doubled over, but, you know, I brushed it off, came off the stage, and I mean, that night I could barely straighten up, you know, from the pain. So what do? I go get a massage, thinking it's muscle relaxing, you know, this and that. And I couldn't even lift the bag on the plane when I would go to put my bag overhead. I was like, I would jump down real fast from the pain in my back. And the doctor told me at the time it was probably my pancreas and gallbladder letting me know. That was the sickness coming on. I mean, it was pancreatic cancer stage 2, and usually stage 3 and 4 pancreatic cancer, there's hardly survival. People don't survive. It's really aggressive. You know, we really have to pay more attention to our body. The signs are there. It tells you everything, but we just don't pay attention.
So it sounds like your treatment has been pretty successful. And are you finished with the chemo now?
Yeah, my last chemo was New Year's Eve.
Oh, congratulations.
I know. That was so cool.
Just brutal to go through that. And you must be so happy to be done with that.
I am, but I wanted to get away faster. But, you know, I have to be patient and not to go out and overdo things yet because I'm still in the healing process, you know. And the funniest part is I'm going to be out on the road as these changes are going, as the hair is growing and my eyelashes and eyebrows are coming back. I'm going to be working and people's going to be seeing all this stuff happen as I see it, you know. So I'm nervous. I'm so happy that I'm getting back into the swing of things, but I'm nervous.
Because your performances on stage, I mean, they're pretty mad energetic.
I know, and and right now I'm just like, I can't walk a good half a block right now without, you know, so.
You know, I know for a lot of people that have been through chemotherapy, everybody's got headphones on. Like, there are a lot of people just use music to help them get through it.
And I was the opposite.
Oh, no kidding.
And no music, no headphones. Music is my joy, is my happiness. And that's what everyone don't seem to understand. They're like, what? You didn't listen to music? Like, no. I didn't feel happy with my music. I couldn't keep it on my mind because that's a whole nother Sharon. But I'm getting the music back into me. You know, it's been a rough road these last few months. And, you know, music is my joy. And since I've been sick, I can't concentrate on the music. I just basically concentrate on trying to get well.
But the sun is coming with all of his might. I know it'll be all right.
Through darkness and pain, sorrow and pain,
we prove again and again and again.
We get along
through all of our lives.
Now, was the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, was that the first time you performed?
Well, that was the first time I really did perform. But in October, I did my pastor, my preacher at my church, she was celebrating her 10th anniversary. And that Saturday, they had a dinner for her. And I sang for the first time I was able to do, I did In the Garden, you know. That song, I Come to the Garden Alone. You know, I did that song. And then that Monday, I had rehearsal with the band, and we went through all 10 songs on the album.
I loved it, the Macy's Day Parade. You sang Ain't No Chimneys in the Project.
Thank God we lip sync. I didn't have to really sing, so that was that.
Everybody's
pretty...
lip syncs at the parade, though, right?
Yeah, you lip sync. But that waving and that turning, and it was cold. That's something you do once in a lifetime. You know, I can sit back and say, yeah, in 2013, I did that old Macy's Day Parade.
When I was a child, I used to wonder how Santa put my toys under the tree. I said, Mama, can you tell me how this can be when there ain't no chimneys in the project?
Ain't no chimneys in the project.
My guest is Sharon Jones. She and her band, the Dap Kings, have an album coming out on Tuesday called Give the People What They Want. What strikes me just from right at the beginning, right from the first track, Retreat, is that even though you all have been at this for a while, the band has been together for a while, it sounds so fresh.
When I recorded that, it's been over like a year and a half, and Retreat was the first release. When I got sick, Retreat had a whole different meaning. It wasn't no longer I was talking to this guy. That was the cancer, and I tell him this sickness to retreat.
Until you're off, and then I'll speak to you. So if you know what's good for you,
retreat.
Hey, 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 retreat, yeah. Step back, boy, because you can't fix crazy. Retreat, retreat, yeah. Raise your white flag high, cause I'm coming in crazy.
You know, because it was interesting listening to the album and the rest of the songs on it. There are several that I think probably might have a different meaning for you having gone through your recovery.
Oh, yeah. Even when I was recording Stranger to My Happiness, you know, the guys said, we're going to do the video. And I looked in the mirror and I said, wow, do I really want to do this video with no hair? Do I really want to do this video with this port sticking out of top of my chest? And then the more I thought about it, yeah, let me do this. Let my fans see what I'm going through. That's part of my healing process, is to not try to hide the way I look or stay away another 8 or 9 months until my hair grow back or until I think I'm strong enough. And then I think also maybe someone out there that's going through cancer and is going through what I'm going with can see that. You know, life doesn't stop. All sickness isn't unto death, you know, and you got to keep going, because if you get into it, that's part of the healing. That'll help you heal faster if you try to get back into your routine.
It's hard to pick a favorite, but I love the groove on You'll Be Lonely. That was written by a baritone sax player, right?
Chime, Kochimia. You know, yeah. His people are from the Yaqui Indians up in Alaska. So, you know, he got that Indian thing in him. And that's why when I first heard that, so I think the groove, isn't it a beautiful groove?
How does it come together when you do that? Like, how do you sort of test drive the tune? Like, I imagine obviously you wrote that with you in mind, and how do we come to the
you
version
know what?
You hear on the album?
The guys, when they write a song, they know I'm going to sing it, and they know it's got to be a story that I want to tell, you know, because if you write something stupid, you know, portraying me as like a maniac or someone that's running somebody down, like my drummer Homer wrote the song, and I'm like, what do this mean? I said, you got me sounding like I'm chasing some guy. I'm nobody's fool. You know, I'm not going to run nobody down and beg nobody. So that's not me. So don't even have me sing it like that, you know. But Coach Jimmy, his song about You'll Be Lonely, and knowing him over the years, and I know what he's going through. So when he wrote that song, I understand what he was talking about.
So I'm looking at your tour schedule here.
Don't look at it. Don't tell.
It's brutal. You're playing 13 cities next month, from New York to Dallas.
Oh, I know.
The following month is just as busy. Are you concerned about overdoing it now?
No, the doctor told me just take my time. The doctor had faith in me. Dr. Leonardo, he's such a great doctor. He was like, don't push yourself. You know, you feel how you feel. And the guys in the band got my back no matter what. If I go out, and if I'm out there 15, 20 minutes, I look at them like, I can't do it. They know I can walk off and they can jam something and I can come back on. I have no idea. But the way I believe in my faith, and I sing this song in church, I don't believe he brought me this far to leave me. I got a feeling that all these shows, all this, everything is my part of my blessing. In my heart, I know I'm going to do every show and everything is going to be okay.
What do you think you're going to be saying to your fans when you hit that stage?
I have no idea. That's just follow my heart. I know it'll probably be a lot of crying. Get some tissues ready.
Sharon Jones leads the band The Dap Kings. Her long-awaited new album is called Give the People What They Want. Sharon, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I'm coming home.
For the week ending January 12th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Mary Dew, Linya Anwar, Daniel Hajek, and Francesca Fenzi. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. How do you pronounce that? That's okay. Stephen? Our technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leia Dell'Aquila and Marcia Caldwell. Jason DeRose is standing in for Mathoni Maturi as senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.